Hello and welcome to Fresh Dialogues. I'm Alison Van Diggelen. This week's podcast is a deeply personal story of how the COVID-19 pandemic impacted my family. A short version of my story aired this week on the BBC World Service programme Health Check. I dedicate it to my beloved mother and to anyone who's lost a loved one recently. Humans are not just statistics. Every single human life is precious, and I offer sincere thanks to Isabel, Laura, and Mary, who shared their poignant and hard-earned wisdom about dealing with death. The COVID pandemic has forced me to have a deeply uncomfortable conversation with my sisters. The topic, our mother's death. Despite warnings not to visit the elderly, my younger sister drove 500 miles to visit her mother. A puzzling phone conversation convinced her that her 80-year-old mum needed help urgently. So we made a pact one night. If mum did catch COVID, we'd keep her at home, come hell or high water. The thought of our super sociable mum lying alone in a hospital bed, struggling for breath with no one holding her hand, broke our hearts. Just a few hours later, I woke to the news that hell had arrived. Mum fell during the night and broke her pelvis. My sister watched, impotent, pleading, as the ambulance crew, decked out in full body protection, stretchered her away. Grimacing in pain, Mum grasped at my sister's hand. "Don't worry, I'll be okay," she said. "You know I'm a tough old woman." We feared that might be the last time we'd see her alive. I'm 5,000 miles away, sheltering in place in California, where I've lived for more than 2 decades. Earlier this year, Health Check asked me to explore a watershed moment in American healthcare. For the first time since the 1970s, more Americans are dying at home than in hospital. My first reaction was, nope, I can't go there. Like many of us, I feared facing death. But now it hit home for me, like an avalanche of mother-daughter worry. Witnessing the isolation of COVID hospital patients in painful technicolor online and the inability of loved ones to say goodbye has brought it all into sharp focus. So why are the majority of Americans now choosing to die at home and not in hospital? Do they miss out on specialist care and pain relief? What is a good death? And what will be the lasting impact of COVID on all this? I spoke with Laura Carstensen, who directs the Center for Longevity at Stanford University. She points out the mismatch between what the medical system traditionally offers and what people imagine at the end of life.
Medicine historically has said we'll throw everything we can at a person to keep them alive, and is not necessarily what people want or is necessarily what a typical person would think is a good idea.
Today, about 80% of Americans say they want to die at home, or at least not in hospital. In response, hospice care has grown rapidly over the last 10 years. The modern-day hospice movement was started in the UK in the late 1960s by a former nurse, Dame Cicely Saunders, who wanted to focus on the relief of symptoms like pain whilst attending to patients' emotional and spiritual needs away from a hospital environment. Most American hospice workers provide care in patients' homes. Isabel Stenzel Burns works for Mission Hospice, a non-profit organization in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Everyone deserves dignity at the end of life. But death is the ultimate equalizer. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, or black or white, American or from another country, we will all die. And so one of the philosophies of hospice care is to give each and every individual a death with love, support, presence, understanding, and dignity. We want to honor the life that people live and also help them exit this world with grace and support.
But, she cautions, there's a risk of romanticizing death at home. It's not always calm and predictable.
Death is hard, hard work for the patient who's dying and the person caring for that patient and family members. Death is a long process of making peace. Though there are opportunities in learning and acceptance, it can still be something that most of us will fight against. As Dylan Thomas said, most of us will not go gently into that good night. In hospice, we know that people die the way they live. And so if somebody was defiant and angry and even hostile to other people, they're probably going to be that way at the end of life, unless there has been some deep internal shift, which we don't see as often as we would like, maybe more in the movies.
Since 1982, Medicare has paid for hospice care services, providing their doctors say they have less than 6 months to live and they decline curative treatments like chemotherapy and ventilators. This can save patients exorbitant hospital bills. Instead of trying to prolong life at all costs, Mission Hospice's Mary Matheson explains that her team focuses on the quality of life, an approach she calls Cabernet over chemo. But dying at home isn't just about saving money. It's also driven by educational and cultural factors. Influential doctors like Atul Gawande have helped shift attention towards palliative care, as well as death-positive movements like death cafes, where people are encouraged to meet for tea and discuss death. Online awareness sites like The Conversation help to reduce the cultural taboo around death. So does Stanford's Laura Carstensen believe that COVID-19 has jolted the world into considering the option of dying at home even more?
I have already said to my husband, if I had COVID and I was having difficulty breathing, don't take me to the hospital. I don't want to die in a hospital under the circumstances that are going on today. And I know a lot of people are saying that. I have lots of relatives and friends in New York who have said they're absolutely saying, do not take me to a hospital. That's the last place I want to go if I have COVID and I'm coming to the end of my life.
The forced isolation of COVID patients is necessary to protect the wider community, but it's troubling to think of patients dying alone.
It's even worse than that because, yes, they're surrounded by medical professionals, but medical professionals who at this particular point in time are incredibly stressed themselves, overburdened. It's hard to imagine that people have time to sit and hold the hand of someone, even if you're the medical professional, not the loved one, right? So there is every reason to think that a lot of people are ending up in their very last, you know, minutes of life very much alone.
Isabel Stenzel-Burns is also a bereavement expert and worries that the speed of the virus doesn't allow for anticipatory grief.
I'm very concerned that bereavement due to a COVID death will have complications, added regrets, perhaps some guilt, some what we call counterfactual thinking. I should have, I could have, I would have done something differently. The people who are bereaved, I hope that they will be able to seek out support from professionals if they need it, and that know that they are not alone. The one solace that I find in this epidemic is the collective grief that we are all experiencing, that everyone on the planet, everyone in this world is impacted by COVID in some way. And so you're not alone if you have lost a loved one to COVID, that there are thousands of people like you who are grieving this devastation.
But Burns also believes a silver lining will come from this pandemic, that it will produce an awakening and help lessen the taboo of death, helping us to realize that simply talking about death will not make it more likely to happen.
I want to recognize that the COVID epidemic is a natural source of anxiety and stress for any of us. It awakens a natural primitive survival instinct in each of us. We want to control as much as possible so that we can survive and live. It confronts us with death, and we can think about death without it happening. You know, there's a myth that if we talk about death, it will happen. That's sort of like saying if we talk about sex, we're going to get pregnant. So that's a complete myth. But what COVID is doing for each and every one of us is helping us kind of put death and dying as a more familiar topic, with the hopes that this idea of death becomes a kitchen table topic, a topic that we can openly discuss with our friends and family about what is most important to us and what our wishes might be when our time comes.
That's exactly what COVID did for my family. For us, the kitchen table was sometimes the precarious connection of a Skype call. After the ambulance crew whisked our mother to hospital, my sisters and I spent an agonizing 8 hours waiting, pacing, and trying to reach the hospital for news. Late that night, they called to say that Mom was coming home. For the last few weeks, my sisters have been caring for her in her crowded little granny flat. We've all had some powerful conversations and some hilarity about what matters most in life and in death. My mother tells me how delighted she is that the potatoes in her garden are beginning to sprout vibrant green shoots. She's also said several times, "I've had a good life. I'd rather go quickly." I take a deep breath and feel sad and impotent so far away. But I've also had time to reflect on this wisdom from Isabel Stenzel Burns, the bereavement counselor.
Ultimately, the more we talk about death, the more we embrace life. That death and life go hand in hand. And if we love life dearly, we also have to love this idea that it will end and we can live more fully by accepting that.
Thank you for listening to Fresh Dialogues. Be well and stay safe.